America.
Straight Talk Africa, coming to you from my home in Arlington, Virginia, a suburb of Washington, D.C., I am Shaka Sali. And today, we reflect on the significance of the concept of Pan-Africanism. Joining us are two distinguished guests, Kumba Thule, coordinator for African Rising, based in Dakar, the Senegalese capital, and Mamo Muchi, research professor in innovation studies at Swane University of Technology in Pretoria, South Africa. Kumba and Mamo, I must say that I am profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host you for the first time on this special edition of Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you so much. I am happy and honored to be here.
You're most welcome.
Thank you very much also. This is a great opportunity to have a very relevant discussion on where Africa has been and where Africa is going. Thank you very much.
You're most welcome, Professor Mamo Muchi. Now, Kumba, when we talk about the concept of Pan-Africanism, what would you say is, to the best of your knowledge, the definition of Pan-Africanism?
If I have to say what Pan-Africanism is, from where I'm standing today as a movement coordinator for the Pan-African movement, Africans Rising for Peace, Justice and Dignity, it is a movement for me. Pan-Africanism is a global, it's an international movement that really aims to build solidarity among Africans, not only Africans in the continent, but Africans outside of the continent. And we claim every African, we claim everyone who's of African descent as part of one people with a shared history. We also share many things in the present, and we share a future. So it is a movement, a solidarity movement. It is a resistance movement. It is a movement about justice, so that every African, every person of African descent, wherever they find themselves on the face of the globe, and no matter what the circumstances are that took them there or have them there, that they have a right to dignity. They have a right to joy and to peace. This is how I define it today. At Africans Rising, we especially claim those who are rising, those Africans who have that consciousness of justice and are working for that solidarity and for that change.
What about you, Professor Mamo Muchi?
Yes.
What is your definition, or what do you understand by the concept of Pan-Africanism?
What did we Africans face throughout our history? We faced slavery first, then colonialism, then imperialism, and after independence, in the 1960s, neo-colonialism. We have not reached to the stage of post-coloniality yet. When this happened to us, these dangers were imposed on us, they did not divide us in terms of, they just said Africans, they just described us like that. They called us pagans, people who don't know how to know anything, knowledge, many things like that. They rejected us. Intellectually, they attacked us. new spheres. So what we need Pan-Africanism is actually for us to actually reject completely this colonial project. The most important one is the Berlin Conference. When the Berlin 84-85 Conference happened, what did they do, the Europeans did? Part of us, Spanish. Part of us, Portuguese. Part of us, French. Part of us, German. Part of us, British. Then they also did, part of them, Italian. That's what they tried to do, rejected. What we need is a vision, a mission, an identity project that actually allows us to come together. So what does it mean to be Pan-African? Pan-African must mean, trust me, for Africans to learn, to unite, to trust each other, work with each other, and not to enter into conflict on borders cynically drawn by the colonial powers. That has to be rejected completely. To reject it, we need to unite. If we don't unite, we can't reject the borders. But what have we been doing over these many coups, fighting, conflict, civil wars, many things we have been doing? This has to be rejected completely. If we don't do this, we are not Pan-Africans. So Pan-Africanism for me is Kwame Nkrumah. Either we unite or we perish. With unity, we have, Africa has a future. Without unity, we always will suffer in a neo-colonial, divided, all right, fighting each other, conflict. That situation is what we're having.
If I heard you correctly then, is it correct that in fact you say that Pan-Africanism was in response to slavery or slave trade and the 1884 Berlin Conference, which was chaired by the German Chancellor Prince Bismarck, without any single African represented on the table?
Absolutely. You're right. We need to reject our past. If we want to know where we want to go, we need to know how we have been going and treated. And that one was negative, and we need to reject it. And the only way we could do it is through our unity. And that unity is what Pan-Africanism means. It means we need to trust each other, work with each other, right?
Yes.
And learn to own our rich resources. That is what Pan-Africanism should provide to us. And once that happens, then we can go ahead.
I see.
I mean, it's not just ideology or anything. It's a reality. It's actually the most powerful weapon Africa has is to unite. But all along, we have not been able to unite. We have leadership crisis, institution crisis, system crisis, governance crisis. It has to be resolved.
Kumba, you talked about how Pan-Africanism, in your view, has people who have a shared history. You're talking about people on the African continent, like where you are, and the African diaspora. If true, do those people also, in your view, have a shared destiny?
Yes, we have a shared destiny. And as it was stated earlier by Professor Omamu, we know that many times the future is born out of the past. We know that we have a shared history. And when I say shared history, we have that shared history that most people know of from our encounter with European and white population. But we also have a shared history that predated that. We have a long, long history of being African before slavery. and have developed many, many engineered, many social ways, economic ways, you name it, artistic way, spiritual ways of being, that yes, have been shaken and many things have been destroyed over the centuries of slavery, colonization, and of course, even neo-colonization and imperialism today, but still very resilient, exists under our own nose, that shared history, that we can still unearth and be inspired from to build a new society, not only for Africans, but for the whole world. So we have a shared destiny, and we have a destiny that if we build it, we would be the hope for a world that has an actual destiny. So to me, Pan-Africanism, I'll say it again, is really about the movement of people who are conscious, African people, people of African descent, who are following a line and a thread of resistance. It didn't start today. It started since we had to resist. But we are following that line of resistance and the knowledge that there is a possibility to come back together, to bring together what we have so that we can live, you know, in dignified ways. We have a shared destiny as Africans, and we can build a destiny for a whole world.
Professor Mamo, do you agree with your fellow panelist, Kumba, that Pan-Africanists, wherever they are, given their shared history, they also have a shared destiny?
We have a shared history.
Yes.
And then from that shared history, we need to develop a shared destiny and a shared future. But on that side, we are very weak. We are not imagining, also we're not also really understanding clearly the knowledge that's needed. And for the imagination, guys, synthesize them to be able to shape, design our future, our destiny. That side is weak. The country where I was born, Ethiopia, what don't we know? We have our own alphabet, our own calendar, right? Knowledge on astronomy. There's a book called Abu Shakal, extraordinary, about the planets, even the naming them, all these things. Binary logic mathematics, the mathematical system that we use for this internet world, came from Africa. What pharmaceutical knowledge, traditional medicine. I just don't want to go to all it. The knowledge heritage from Africa is very rich. All right? The struggle heritage is also very rich. The spiritual heritage is very good, rich. The philosophical heritage is very, very rich. The philosophy that will save not only Africa, the whole world comes from us. Ubuntu, math, many, many things, you know. Sankofa, many, many of the extraordinary things that have been created in Africa. What do we do? We Africans do, the current states do. In the education system, it doesn't exist. We don't teach our children. What do our children learn? Foreign stuff. You see, the entire education system needs to be decolonized. Pan-Africanizing it means also changing, bringing back the rich knowledge, the rich spirituality, right? All these things are, and also the rich struggle that we had, for example, we're now celebrating Adwa great African victory. Why are we celebrating 125 years? They said, sincerely speaking, let me just give you this concrete example. The Europeans said the defeat of it is not a defeat of Italy, it's a defeat of Europe. Why did they say it's a defeat of Europe? They said, how can these barbarians, these people who say they're pagans, they don't know anything, how come they have the kind of quality leadership that makes them win? When they don't have army, they don't have weapons, how did they manage to be? They walk on the street, and then they defeated us. How can this happen? How come that these people who don't know anything, they don't have knowledge, can create it? So it was an intellectual victory. It was a leadership victory. And just a spiritual victory. That's why we call it Adwa. Adwa victory continues as part of the Pan-Africanism.
You keep making references to the Battle of Adwa, or 1896. But you do not give us the context in which Adwa becomes very important in African history and therefore in Pan-African history, especially because you are talking about a time when the gallant sons and daughters of Ethiopia defended their territory against the invasion of Italy. So why don't you put in context the Battle of Adwa? I have seen, of course, Sankofa, a film made by your fellow Ethiopian, my friend Haile Gerima.
Haile Gerima, yes.
Put Sankofa in context for our audience. What was the Battle of Adwa really and its Pan-African significance?
I think the Battle of Adwa is extremely significant because all Europeans, let me just give you one just concrete, what a French historian on March 4, 1896, said about the Battle of Adwa and how he linked it to Africa as a whole. The defeat of the Italians by King Menelik is an event which you should keep in your memories forever. It is the waking up of Africa to meet what has been hitherto the disdainful seizure by Europeans of these countries, which we call barbarians. It must not be forgotten that in many of these countries now reverted to barbarism, there formerly existed an extremely advanced civilization, and that Ethiopia in particular enjoyed throughout Africa great renown for its refinement and wealth. The defeat of the Italians by Menelik would be remembered in history forever. This victory will arouse the spirit of the Africans, who until today have been treated with contempt as pagans. Menelik's victory is a victory of all of Africa. This kind of commentary is going to be strongly evident in the future. Since it travels fast with the wing of air across the desert, the news is known now from end to end in those African countries. In the future too, since it's known that Africa defeated Europe, it will create a sense of defense and raise the level of consciousness of millions of Africans. It is not comfortable to be happy with the defeat of the Italians. This defeat is ours, and that of others. It's a defeat of colonial Europe, and tomorrow's Europe too. You see, how come he actually expressed it as Pan-Africanism? And he's a French historian who's angry that by the defeat of Europe. And he says, it's not just a defeat now, it will be a defeat also tomorrow. Meaning Adwa victory, African, with great African victory continues. Why we say it like that is the following. Please understand me carefully. At the Berlin Conference, when they divided Africa, they allocated, it's the European, the people who were in that meeting that allocated to Italy, this what they now call Horn of Africa. Somalia, Djibouti, Eritrea, now Ethiopia. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they allocated it like that. Then when this defeat happened in half a day, it's extraordinary. What did they say? All of Europe, you will not believe it. The President Thabo Mbeki gave a brilliant lecture on the 125, and he covered how the world press covered it. You know what they said? This is a defeat of Europe. And the defeat by Africa over Europe. How can these people who know nothing, and it's also an intellectual victory, they say. It's all, no, sincerely, they say it like that. Also leadership. How come they have, Africans have this kind of leadership? What will this give big lessons to the rest of Africa to continue to fight? And definitely did.
One could say it was arguably a major psychological blow to the European imperialism.
Yes, very good. Yes, thank you. You put it better.
You're most welcome. Now, Kumba, who are some of the giants of Pan-Africanism when we talk about Pan-Africanism? We know, of course, that there are names like Marcus Garvey. There are names like George Padmore. There are names like Sylvester Williams, Makonnen. There are names like Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois. Who are the others, and especially those from the African continent? Of course, not forget the Osagyefo, Dr. Kwame Nkrumah.
Giants. You know, there are names we know that you can easily find and that at least you can hear from radios and TV. But there are many, 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 I would say, invisible giants. And many of them are women. When we start talking about giants of Pan-Africanism, most of the names that come out are names of men.
Right.
In Senegal here, people will know of maybe Cheikh Diop, and even him. Cheikh Diop, there is a beautiful film called Kemti by Usman William, a documentary film that shows really his work, not only as a historian, as a scientific, you know, with datation and the work he's done with reading, you know, the hieroglyphs. But I'd like to name people like André Bloin. I'd like to name people like Awa Keita. I'd like to name Jean-Martin Cissé. And I'd like to challenge those who are listening to us to look and figure out who were the mothers of the independences. Mm. To look and find out who were the women who made our struggles possible.
You could also talk about the Senegalese founding president, Leopold Senghor. Yeah. And what about his contribution to the concept of negritude with people like MSZO Martinique?
When you talk about Pan-Africanism, again, you have intellectual movements, you have people in schools and universities, and there is a lot of people who shared that time being students together, at least from, if we take it from West Africa, those who were students in France, that the group that worked on the, you know, negritude. But you have to also look at, you know, cultural movements among artists, you know. Yes, writers, musicians, people might remember the festival of Black, Festival International in Senegal, or the Black Art Festival that was done under Senghor. There are still documents and images of people from all over the diaspora, the, you know, the Nigerian youths, the musicians, everybody meeting in Dakar. So there is and there has been an artist movement for Pan-Africanism. You also have the political movement. You have the thread of politicians. And again, whether they're female or male, of people who believe in the Pan-African project, of people who did not think that it's about them being a president of a small piece of land somewhere on the continent, but have the profound belief that it would make sense to build unity across the African continent, and in that unity to claim Africans from the diaspora. So yes, we need to take, when we speak of Pan-Africanism, we take account of all of the pieces. Today, the young people who are fighting to change, the currency, like the franc, the CFA franc, in West Africa, I believe, are part of this movement of Pan-Africanism. People today who are fighting against the illicit financial flows, the money that is taken out of Africa to basically leave this continent bleeding so that our resources can be used elsewhere. We're not even talking about the past. We're talking about today, what's happening. People who are standing against that, to me, are, the Pan-Africans of today.
If you look at Pan-Africanism today, would you agree that to some degree, one of your compatriots in Senegal, Youssou N'Dou, does in fact contribute to Pan-Africanism using his music?
Yes, I think in the art field, this is where I see even stronger the movement of Pan-Africans. Sometimes in the political field, it's harder. Many of our politicians, many of our presidents on our continent today might be far from Pan-Africanism, or at least they can speak about it, but not really enacting it. But in the art field, we find easier many times, in all kind of art, whether it's writers, musicians. We talk of Youssou N'Dou, we have Baba Mal, who's here. There are so many artists who clearly, if you ask them, they see really the need of Pan-Africanism, and they know that, and they cannot be limited to the nation states that we have inherited, violent nation states actually that we've inherited from colonialism. Wow. Yes. I would say the artists are the really backbone and the strong vehicle for Pan-African movement.
Pan-Africanism, in fact, was essentially went home to the African continent where it belonged after the Second World War. And that location was then the Gold Coast, which eventually became Ghana on March 6, 1957, when Nkrumah regained Ghana's political independence from the British.
Absolutely.
And what about the significance of the statement made by Kwame Nkrumah, challenging the Ghanaians that the independence of Ghana would be meaningless unless it was linked with the total liberation of the rest of Africa. And he did not simply talk the talk, he actually walked the talk by providing some of the necessary tools so that, in fact, his colleagues in the other parts of the African continent could liberate their nations.
Yes. No, he was amazing. He was a genuine Pan-Africanist. And it's amazing what he said. I just want to tell you what he said when he was going to London, from London to America, Lincoln University. He saw the Italians attacked Ethiopia. Look what he said. At that moment, it was almost as if the whole of London had declared war on me personally. For the next few minutes, I could do nothing but glare at each impassive face, wondering if these people could realize the wickedness of colonialism and praying that the day might come when I could play my part in bringing about the downfall of such a colonial system. My nationalism surged the fore. I was ready to go to hell itself, if need be, in order to achieve my object. That's what he said. What it means is he genuinely was Pan-African. He felt Ethiopia was attacked by the Italians. He felt as if he was going to hell. He could not understand all these people, he said, by seeing that. He was passing by London. Yes. And in London, he heard the news that Ethiopia is attacked by Italian fascists. Then he reacted like that. So Kwame Nkrumah was genuinely Pan-Africanist. But look what happened. What did they do to him?
You are watching Straight Talk Africa, and we'll be right back with you. So please, don't go away.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Lino Khmudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
You're welcome back to Straight Talk Africa. And today, we reflect on the significance of the concept of Pan-Africanism. My guests are Kumba Thule, coordinator of Africans Rising, and from South Africa, Mamo Muchi, research professor in innovation studies at Tshwane University of Technology.
Modern day Pan-Africanist at the time was Colonel Gamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt.
Yeah.
You agree?
Yes, I always have to bring us back maybe to today also. In my view and perception, there are many Pan-Africanists today. People who may be today in Ghana, but are supporting the struggle of people who are in Uganda today. People who may be in Senegal and are supporting the struggle of people in Cameroon. Mm. That spirit of Kwame Nkrumah, of Gamal Abdel Nasser has not died. It has multiplied. There are many people who believe in this and see those that truth. Now, our challenge is to be able to get to the point where we can not only connect our struggle, but that they can get into a situation of power when they can be the one making the decision about our countries. The visibility of people like Nkrumah is connected to the fact that they were at the head of their country at the time. Today we are missing on this continent right now is people in politics, people in leadership situations that have the courage and the level of consciousness of those Pan-Africanists.
What about the vision of those Pan-Africanists?
The vision?
Yeah, you are talking about the courage. What about also the vision?
Yes, the consciousness first, to know what Mamo was saying, that we have a shared history, to understand what are today the leaders on the African continent who have that knowledge, that consciousness, that vision, and that courage, who are in power for the people of Africa. That's who we are missing. And that's who the young people of Africa have need to set. This is our job, to really make sure that we have at the head of our states, if we can call them states, people who that you need, people who are Pan-Africanists in the sense that we are talking about today, which right. means that they really consider that Africans, whoever they are, deserve the riches of Africa, that they deserve to live. And having those kind of people in power is what would make a real African Union exist. And even the question about, United States of Africa, we can do better. We can do better than the United States itself if we are able to put in the kind of leadership that we will need.
I was wondering, Momo, what would you say are some of the most important accomplishments by the Pan-Africanist movement or the Pan-African movement so far?
At least we should say that Africa has at least moved from all of our African states now are politically at least independent, although economically they are not independent. They are still dependent. The inter-African trade is very low. Inter-European trade, inter-Asian trade is very high. Why? Because our relationship is still, economically, is still with the colonial powers, the former colonial powers. For example, the country where she is, Senegal and others, although they struggled in Senegal a lot, still the relationship is more stronger with the former colonial powers. So we have this situation now. Now, the important thing is we have achieved something together, which means political. Now what we need to achieve is economic independence also. And then all these efforts, at least on the talking side, on producing protocol, but the effort to try to make it, we even in the Africa Union, we have many, many protocols we do, but in actual fact, we don't get, we have not yet reached. We have now the inter-African trade, anything like that. In terms of realization, we're still at the stage where we should be.
Kumba, the Organization of African Unity, which was founded in 1963 with the mandate or the goal of making sure that the entire African continent is politically decolonized. That goal was accomplished in 1994 when apartheid South Africa became independent under the Madiba. Nelson Mandela became the first indigenous president of the Republic of South Africa. Now, the OAU has since been replaced by the African Union, whose goal is to bring about economic independence. What are your expectations of the African Union to accomplish its goal of bringing about economic independence for Africa?
I have extremely high expectation of the African Union about liberation of this continent. And yes, when we talk about liberation today, and we talk about economic liberation, we mean that the riches of the African continent serve the African people first. We know that today, though, with the type of leadership that we have on this continent, we don't think that it's going to be very easy to get to that, because many of our leaders would rather serve those who are oppressing us. We said it earlier, we are lacking that vision. that courage. So the big job and the big work on this continent is to put in leadership people who are ready for African liberation in all of the senses of the world. And economic liberation doesn't happen alone. It happens with political liberation. Yes, there are independencies. And yes, we have big wins, you know, with the anti-apartheid movement, with the fact that at least we don't have, you know, France being settled in Senegal and be the people that we have to respond to directly. But even our political liberation is not complete. The colonial project has taken a different form. It happens behind doors, and it is our own people that are used against us. Today, it's a challenge for an African who believes in Africa, who is a Pan-Africanist, who is someone who wants to make change happen, to be able to succeed, to be in power in an African country, let alone to stay there long enough to be able to push something different at the African Union. But change is on the way. It's going to happen. People at a time didn't think that slavery would ever end, or the same way people at the time thought that the colonial project will never cease, the same way they thought that apartheid is the way to be and will be forever, the same way today people think that this world economic model that is enslaving us, people think that this is the way and it will continue. But we know that it will come a day where it will change and it will crumble, and we'll work every day, every time, everything that we have, we put it in there to make sure that that change also happens.
Luckily, critics say that the only constant is change. And when you look at the demographic changes that are happening on the continent in tandem with social media, I think that those who are optimistic about changes have very good reason to be even hugely optimistic. What about you, Mamo? What do you think should happen in order for the African Union to deliver economic liberation for Africa, so that the people of Africa become the beneficiaries of their God-given wealth?
Thank you. Thank you for the question. But our sister has explained it very nicely. And I just want to continue on her ideas. I think there's very, very important that the African Union must fund itself first. A lot of the funding still comes from outside.
Correct.
And if it comes from outside, outside interests will continue to influence us. So the other key point is that six times more resources flow out of Africa than what comes in. We actually donate to the rest of the world. We're not donated. No, sincerely. And it's how many billions every year go out with the illicit financial flows. We are in a economic logic of debt, loan, and aid. We must get out of that. We don't need loan. We don't need debts to be indebted. All right? And we don't need aid. What we need to know is an economic strategy, an innovation system, a sustainable, integrated economy arrangement in Africa to agree like that. And if the African Union can actually do it, that would be wonderful. I remember attending the 50th anniversary of the OAU. I went to the African Union. But the discussions people were making were not practical, what I saw. Very good to produce protocols, but actually action-oriented ideas, not easy. For example, look whatever you say about Gaddafi. I mean, he wanted to create the African Afro. He actually had enough gold. But he said, Africa does not need the World Bank and the IMF. It creates its own World Bank and IMF, the African one. So when that happened, what did they do? Sarkozy and others, they fought him and they killed him. And now look at what's happening to Libya. What we have in Africa is genuinely, as my sister said it, the leadership has to change. And as you also said it, we need leaders that serve the people, that serve Africa. For example, Thomas Sankara, what did he do? He reduced his salary by half. He did not want Mercedes-Benz cars. He used to walk. We need service, public service, not pocket service. We don't need, not feed people for money. If they do like that, then they get connected to all these external actors and then don't really value Africa and our people. We need leaders that value the people and Africa. We need that. Even oppressed humanity in the world with our Ubuntu values, you know, with the value that we have, the philosophy that we have so rich that will save the world comes from Africa. We have originated it. We don't practice it here. So I think what you are just asking is very important. At the moment, the economic challenge on us is very, very strong. When we have the richest resources on this planet, who takes it? Who owns it? What are the companies that do it? External companies, the mining sector, everything. I'm simply saying to you is that unless we change this, and when we are uniting, we need economic unity too. And on the trade level, on the education level, on the technology level, on the inter-African mobility, we need to create many, many, many interesting things that need to be done. We're not doing it systematically.
When you look at the African continent, and we are talking about the needed leadership that can get the continent out of these problems, how can you possibly have that type of leadership with the sort of elections, or selections, some might say, that African countries go through? There are not so many Senegals on the African continent, which are free, fair, transparent, credible elections. We are talking about a continent where there is the absence of social, economic, political justice for all.
Yes, you are so right. You're really touching it. The reality is that today, on the African continent, we have a hard time finding a country where we can be proud of our leaders, where we can name our leaders and say that they will stand for Africans. And that is the first thing we need to, you know, we need to fight. And we are fighting. Nobody is standing still. You see what's happening in Uganda today. Senegal is no different than other countries. People have to fight every day to be able to maintain a semblance of justice. But we understand that doesn't happen just by chance. We know that there are deep-rooted interests globally to make sure that the kind of leaders that comes into leadership in our countries but can stay are the one that can serve the interests of the same one who colonizes. We understand that. And we need to be able to get out of that. And today, our own proposition is that there is a need for African unity, not just of African unity of states. I think women of Africa needs to unite. I think workers of Africa needs to unite. Artists of Africa needs to unite. Different segments of Africans intellectual professors. We don't have to wait for our countries to get the type of leaders that we need. We need to be able to unite as groups, as corporations, and go beyond these, as we said it earlier, these fake nation state that will force upon us, and be regional, in our approaches. So, and this is what we need to push at the level of African Union and everywhere, to make sure that there is a space for the civil society groups, the movement, the organizations, the workers' unions, to be able to unite and build that vision of a united Africa.
Former U.S. President Barack Hussein Obama has said that even prosperity without freedoms is a form of fundamental poverty. How do you react to that?
To me, I believe in freedom, and people being free to make choices is what will make the difference. There will be no prosperity without freedom. People have to be able to participate to the governance of their own lives, what belongs to them, how it needs to be used, what they want to do or don't want to do about their lives. When the prosperity is for all, of course, freedom is a component of it, for women, for young people, for people of different genders, different ethnicity. Everyone needs to be free, and without that, there is no meaning to any prosperity.
Thank you. What about you, Momo?
I think the important thing is for us to also not ignore our own rich traditional knowledge about governance also. We should learn something from it. We should contextualize it in the African setting. What are the kind of things that have been very useful? Instead of now copying these Western political parties, forming so many political parties, all right, and then competing with each other, and then building political parties on the basis of ethnicity, on many things like that, with again, all these political parties getting foreign support and foreign interests and dividing us. No, this is not going. This is not freedom. This is oppression. I'm telling you. What? Just give me a concrete example. I give you a concrete example. I'm not saying we should be like China, but China had two things. When they were Marxists, they used to give it to what they call Chinese characteristics. And when they, for something like 30 years, they did not want to link with the rest of the world. They want to sort themselves out. They need to find themselves out. We need in Africa something like that. And then what did they do? After 30 years, in 1978, Deng Xiaoping said, let's open our economy. Then other people said to him, why don't you make it a liberal democracy? You know what he said? Are you crazy? Do you want to create chaos in China? Even one political communist party is too big for us, too many for us. What we need, he said, no, sincerely, what we need is all of us must learn how to agree, even when we disagree, to re-agree. The main project is the people, to eradicate poverty and to make sure China is secure. That's what we need to do. And then now in last year, in 2020, China eradicated poverty. What we need is, and take also from Norway, when they got oil, one little oil, they don't have resources like we have. They had a one-year debate what to do. They created what they called the Sovereign Wealth Fund. And what did that fund mean? Is a fund, should we give it to the state? No. Should we give it to the companies? No. What should we do? The people of Norway. Now, if you go to Norway, everyone is rich. The whole Scandinavia, they have what they call a social democratic system where you have no problem. Everybody is secure. I worked there for 12 years. I didn't have key for my office. I didn't have key for my where I stay in the house. We don't need it because there's no, unless people are drunk or anything, they will not do any harm. This kind of situation is what we need in Africa. Africa has everything, but we don't know how to manage it. Our politics is very poor. Albert Einstein said there are two infinities in the world, in this world. One is the universe, the other is human stupidity. And you know what he said? I'm not sure about the universe, he said, but you're so sure about human stupidity. We have a lot of human stupidity. I call it the greatest human stupidity Africa faces is the politics. The politics is too dirty. We need to clean it up. To clean it up means, sincerely speaking, is to value the people first, above all everything. How do we create a system to do that? Even when we are politicians, how do we agree to disagree, reagree to solve problems, not to create problems? Something like that is what we need. That is not what we have now in Africa. It's all confused. This confusion is creating problems for us.
What about,
we need to clean it up.
But what about the example of Botswana? Botswana seems to be working. It is not perfect, but seems to be working. And the reason it seems to be working is precisely because of what you said. It taps into its traditional culture.
Definitely. I think what I believe is that it's so possible. What we are talking about is not a faraway dream or an impossible thing to do. Countries, people have done it before. The capacity to consider one's own people, to say that we are African, we deserve the best, we deserve not only to be alive, but to live well. That we will put in front of us as our leaders people who believe in that, and that we will need to live in a world that respects that choice. Because Africans have chosen before leaders that believe in this. And as Mamu said, many of them got somehow eliminated. But the whole world needs to come to term with the fact that this is what we need, that we deserve to be alive, that we deserve to live off our land and of our own riches. That to do that, we need to have the type of leaders that cares about us. The whole world needs to come to term with this. And the tides are turning. The tides are turning. People will have to live with Africans that are knowledgeable, Africans that are courageous, Africans that will make their own choices. There are more and more of us on this earth, and we are not only on the continent, we are everywhere. And there is no way to hold us back. So I think this is a great moment for Pan-Africanism.
Unfortunately, time is not my best ally for that. I have to say that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have had the opportunity to host you on this special edition of Straight Talk Africa for the first time. Thank you
so much for having us.
Thanks to our audience for joining our conversation on Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter, Africa. And please, let's keep the African hopes alive. Thank you.